Reset, the podcast, is brought to you in association with Liars, the non-alcoholic spirits brand. Whether it's low alcohol or no alcohol, Liars helps you enjoy your classic favourite cocktails.
Hello everyone, my name is Suki Thompson. Welcome to Reset, the podcast. A place for you to get some inspiration and advice to help you live a more fulfilling work life. I do hope that your journey to feel more connected, more inspired, just a bit more energized starts here. Take a moment now with me to reset. Sprite's career has not always been without its bumps in the road. My guest today in this Reset podcast, she talks about why these bumps have proved to be her biggest driver. Through the odd failure and the occasional leap of faith, Keris has learned her biggest lessons. Here she describes how those things have taught her that life really is about getting things done and the tenacity to see them through. As Chief Marketing Officer of the BBC, Keris also explains how the power of storytelling has become such an important part of her work life.
Cheers, Keris. Thank you for joining me.
Cheers.
It's lovely to see you with your Americano, I think we've got here.
Yes, I have. Yeah, mine's, I think, a hell of a lot stronger than yours because I ran out of ice. So, but it's non-alcoholic, so it won't, the conversation shouldn't deteriorate on that basis, at least.
No, it shouldn't, should it? It's something rather strange about drinking what feels like an alcoholic drink in the afternoon. But it is rather lovely. And I was asking my son, Sam, because he did the video of how you make it. And he was saying that an Americano, which is the sort of, you know, it was a drink of in Italy in the 1860s. Anyway, now, you started your life in sort of educational business as a scientist. And your PhD, I think, was in molecular neuroscience. Is that right?
That's right. Yes. Yeah.
Why did you decide to do a PhD in molecular neuroscience?
I don't think I haven't asked that question of myself a number of times. To be honest, I think one of the fortunate people that was studying something at university that they came to deeply love. I really enjoyed biology when I was at school. And it was the thing I was most interested in, and so decided to do it as an undergraduate. And I really found myself in something that I really, really, really enjoyed. And whilst some of the first terms were quite tough, because I had actually not done very well in my A-levels, and so I assumed I was going to be at the bottom of the class. And so I was sort of slightly deeply anxious when I first arrived. So overstudied, and then did really well. And as I started to do really well, I thought, well, I better keep doing really well. So I kind of worked, but I really enjoyed it. And I did well, but I sort of found myself in something that I found intellectually really stimulating. And I was good at it. And I did a research project in my final year as an undergraduate that went extraordinarily well. And we wrote papers that got published, and this hardly ever happens. And I thought, this is really, really great. And I was living and working in Sussex, in Brighton. I went to the University of Sussex, and I'd come from, for many of your listeners, maybe they might know, I grew up in Basildon in Essex, and Brighton is very different to Basildon.
Yeah.
So, as anyone will know, I was in heaven living that life in Brighton, doing well at something I enjoyed. And I was asked whether I wanted to stay on. And to be honest, I was a bit flattered that someone would think I could do that. I didn't want to leave. I didn't want to leave Brighton. I didn't actually want to leave academia or university. And I thought I'd be an academic. And I thought, what more interesting thing to do to continue this sort of path? Having had some success as an undergraduate. And so I stayed and I started my postgraduate life. And I don't think you could get anything so wrong, you know, sort of how different the contrast was for the life as a postgraduate compared to my experience as an undergraduate. And I was deeply unhappy. I found it really difficult. It's a life of failure, actually, being a scientist, because you're experimenting all the time and nothing works. And I, even though my undergraduate project had been very successful, it was a bit of luck, I think, that it had been successful so fast. And that was not my experience. And I just found it really, really hard. And I had to really kind of dig deep. I think I was just really unhappy. But I actually pretty much, like most people, because only a third of people that start a PhD ever go on to finish it, actually, I thought I was going to give up. But I didn't want to give up, and I didn't, it's interesting, I've thought about, have I been asked about why? I didn't want to have to tell the story forever about why I failed in my PhD, and I didn't want to tell the story of having spent 2 years doing something and having nothing to show for it. And so actually, I just decided, right, it's like you give up or you just get it done. And I thought, I want to get it done. I don't want to talk about having failed in the first 2 or 3 years and then starting something else. I'd rather tell the story of why I did something and it wasn't what I wanted to do. And this is genuine. It's not like looking back in hindsight, because I remember thinking, and I can take myself back to sitting in my room and thinking, are you going to give up or are you going to get it done? And I just thought, I'm going to get it done, but I don't want to continue. And I just want to get a job. And all of my friends were in their sort of like second year of their working lives. And I thought, I want some money. You know, £3,500 a year is not a lot of money, even though that's like 30 years ago, it still wasn't a lot of money to live on. I wanted some money. I wanted to start my life. That's what it felt like. It felt like just get it done and then start afresh. And so I did it because I thought I'd be an academic, because I thought I understood what it meant. And I thought it would be a good life for me. And it was just wrong. I was not a good fit. Everything I loved doing, teaching, talking about the work, I was the only person I knew who actually quite liked standing up front of the 200 scientists and talking about the work. It kind of tells you something when everybody else loves doing the work, you like talking about the work. And I sort of thought, right, what does that tell you about you versus whether you've really got what it takes to spend the next 10 years? I would have loved to have run a lab. I would have liked to have had other people doing the work on my behalf and to have been an academic and teaching. I think that would have suited me very well. I just didn't want to do the 10 years that it would have taken me to get to that position. I think I was a bit impatient. So I thought, right, I'm going to get it done, but I will go and do something else and I will just start working life.
And that's so interesting, because we've known each other quite a long time. Yeah. It must be, yeah. I think it must be at least 15 years. So you were at AkzoNobel when I first met you.
Yeah, ICI, I think, actually.
ICI, yeah, oh, ICI, yeah. As it was merging with, and, yeah. You know, and then through your time at BA, Ideal Standard, Virgin Media, BBC. And actually, that's so interesting that you talk about that story. There's two things there that struck me. One is the, you know, you start in your undergraduate world and you were very good, but you worked unbelievably hard to be amazing. That as a characteristic is what I see of you. And the, you either kind of give it up or get it done. Mm. And I see that about you a lot. That, you know, sometimes you have the most amazing stamina and your resilience and grit to just get stuff done. And you are an extraordinary marketeer, actually. And, you know, certainly the brands you've worked with, but also the kind of career that you've had. But you never feel like you take it for granted, because you always work really hard. Do you see that in yourself?
Well, thank you for saying some of those really kind things. I think there have been occasions when I've given up, right? So I've sort of turned my back on things and decided not to just keep going. So I'm sure we'll come on to some of those things. Maybe you've walked away or run away or chosen a different path that people didn't expect. But I think you're right in that. You know, I was brought up by a family. I always expected to work reasonably hard. I think early failure is quite a good thing. I went to a terrible school. I did quite well in my O-levels. I fell in love at 16 and spent most of my A-levels doing what you do when you're 16 and in love, which is not conducive to getting good A-levels, frankly. And I was at a comprehensive school. No one was going to push me to do anything. And I didn't do very well. And it was a bit of a shock. Well, it wasn't a shock because I knew I wasn't going to do very well, but it was a wake-up call. And I thought, and this will, your listeners who are in our generation will know the decision, do I want to go to polytechnic with my average A levels?
Yeah.
Or try again and go to university, which I'd set my heart on, because from Basildon I wanted to go to university. And so I sort of thought, right, I'm going to go. So I took a year out. I retook one that I'd done very badly in and got the grades to go to university. So I think it really helped me, the fact that I'd failed. And it meant, for good or bad, that when I arrived at university, I fully expected to be in the bottom of the class. I'd scraped in. I'd scraped in. And therefore, I thought, I've got to work hard early, because I've scraped in and I do not want to fail again. And you suddenly realise that then if you work hard and apply yourself, and I did really, really well early. And then this fear of, well, I can't, now I'm sort of doing really well. I don't not want to do really well. So you keep working. But I think it came out, I only worked so hard at the early bit because I thought I had to, and I knew I had to apply myself if I was going to succeed or at least do well. And I wanted to do well. And so I think that was, I've thought about this quite hard. And I think had I had a different type of education and been encouraged a bit more at school, not from my parents are wonderful, but had different opportunities, I wouldn't have, I think, worked so hard, because I'd have assumed it would have come. And as many will know, university is very different. You're on your own. You're on your own. No one's going to speak. You're on your own. And I was used to being on my own because I knew what it was like. So, I think it was quite defining of me. A bit of early failure was pretty helpful, because it meant that I then I did really, really well. But I also think I was lucky, or good judgment, I don't know. I chose to study something I enjoyed. Yeah. And you're good at it, blah, blah, blah. And I think that's also, I'd say that is a theme of my career, that I've enjoyed what I do. Not all the time, let's face it. Working sometimes is really tough. I like the businesses I've worked in. I enjoy what I do. It's fun and it suits me really well. I think a real balance of, I've talked about art and science, yeah, left brain and right brain. I'm not either one of those. I'm never going to be a brilliant scientist or an uber creative. And I'm deeply regretful, because if you're doing a PhD, you better be a good scientist. And I'd love to have been supremely creative. I'm not. I'm in the middle of that. But I think I've found a pathway that serves me well, because I can move between those two worlds reasonably easily. I can appreciate and understand those that come from a very logical side of their brain versus those also that have a sort of creative aspect. And I can sort of travel those worlds and in a way marshal those worlds, I think, quite well. So I think I've sort of found something that's suited me and have therefore been able to enjoy it. And if you mostly enjoy something, as you will know, Suki, there's a good chance that you might do okay, right? Yeah. And so I think that's where I've been lucky, that I studied something that I enjoyed, did well, and then I've found a career that for most intents and purposes I've been able to enjoy, and therefore you can achieve some success if you enjoy it, because you've got to work hard at times, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're right, isn't it, that ability to be able to enjoy, but also I think to work out quite early on what you're really good at. I mean, at the point that you say you liked standing out in front of all the other scientists and presenting, you had this sort of left brain, right brain, the things together. That's so, it's a great insight into your own personal strengths. The podcast is all about resetting, and you've reset a number of times. Yeah. But actually, with one exception, we'll probably talk about that. You've always stayed with businesses. You know, a lot of marketing CMOs, their average tenure is about 18 months. Mm. You stayed a long time at were there for Unilever, you were at ICI, Akzo Nobel for quite a while.
Yeah.
What made you leave there and go to BA for that? Was that your first moment of a big reset about going, okay, I've done this bit of job and now I'm going to do something different?
I think the first one was leaving Unilever, actually. You're right, the first 20 years of my 30 years were only spent in two companies. So I had a very stable first two decades. Leaving Unilever to go somewhere else, that's a massive move, actually, if anyone knows. You're leaving the mothership to go to somewhere else. And I was actually leaving to become marketing director of ICI, and the buck stopped with me in marketing. I was probably the most senior marketer in the company. That was actually a transition, because I've been used to being part and surrounded by many, many more brilliant people who've solved every problem five times over. And suddenly in ICI, the buck stopped with me, and it was I had to lead this team. And I joined a business in crisis. I didn't know that at the time. I don't think I'd have taken the job if I'd known it, but I turned up and it was in a bit of a crisis. So that was a time of a bit digging deep, I think. But also for me, no longer being surrounded by a Unilever network, you've got to build your own network. And I think the rapid learning for me was, the good thing I did is I picked up the phone, right? So I picked up the phone to some smart people like Sarah Palmer, the late Sarah Palmer, who's now with us, from Big Green Door, Paul Walton from the Value Engineers, Andy Bird from Brand Learning. I called up everyone that had helped me and said, help, I'm sort of a little bit in the deep end here. I'm feeling way over my head. Can you help me? And it's amazing, if you've been kind to people as you've been growing up, how they will help you along the way. And those people then helped me, because I no longer had the network inside the company. I had to kind of build it outside of the company. So that was probably the first reset. But I spent 10 years there, almost 10 years. We were acquired by Akzo Nobel, but I was on the inside. So it was interesting. But you're right. I think one of the big resets was deciding to leave. It didn't seem so challenging at the time, because I felt very excited about what I was going to do. I'd spent the last couple of years at ICI working with Akzo Nobel, working with Tex Gunning, who's an inspirational CEO, and I'd been working with him. Really, he was the person that taught me the power of purpose before anyone talked about it.
Interesting.
Way before Paul Polman. Tex Gunning was the leader of Brands with Purpose. I mean, you've got to go way back. And he understood that the work I was doing with Dulux about adding colour to people's lives and Let's Colour, he saw that not just as a customer initiative that's going to grow a business outside. He saw it as a way of igniting the spirit inside the organisation. And he taught me about the power of purpose, not just with customers and consumers, but inside an organisation. So I'd spent 2 years under his leadership. I learned many things about what I wanted to be, but also what not to be from his leadership, I have to say.
Like what?
I always wanted people to know where they stood with me and that they could trust me and I would be straight up, because that wasn't always the experience that I had. And it's deeply uncomfortable when you don't trust and you don't know. Well, maybe you can. You don't know whether you can trust the person that you're working for. You don't know quite the foundation on which you're working and building. And I'm sure that was as much about me as it was about him, but I learned that made me deeply uncomfortable and it did not bring the best out of me. Mm. And I learned that, well, I don't want to be that leader for people that work with me. For good or bad, I think I want them to know me and I want them to know where they stand with me. And I want them to know they can trust me. That doesn't always mean it's going to be good news or comfortable, but they just got to know where they are with me. And I think I learned some of that from some not so positive experiences. But I did learn a really powerful lesson from him about the power of purpose and the role of marketing leaders to build inside the organization. And when BA came knocking on the door, if ever there was a brand at that time that needed to reignite its spirit inside the organization, I thought, I am the person for this job. This has been made for me. And Andrew Crawley, who recruited me, it was a meeting of minds. You know, this was, and if ever a business or a brand needed what I thought I could bring and also what I thought they wanted me to do, there, it was British Airways. So I went.
And I remember it so well.
With excitement. And I think, but what I found was not quite what I expected. And as many people know, in the early stages, the job I went there to do wasn't how it was working out. The company was at a time of change. It was merging with Iberia. There was movements at the top, and I wasn't, nor was the person that hired me, in control of what was going on, really. And you realise big companies, big organisations, they move, they make changes. It doesn't always work in the way that you needed it to work. And it wasn't working for me. The job they wanted me to do was not the job I went there to do. It was a third of the size. All the commercial stuff had gone. And I'm a commercial marketer. I don't make ads. I can make ads, but they're there for a purpose. And it didn't feel right for me. And I also felt, I have to admit, uncomfortable with the way the organisation had approached that change. It unsettled me. And I felt unsettled. And it was very early in my career there. And I think when you don't know the culture, you don't know the organisation, it was quite an unsettling time. And I was a little bit blindsided by what was happening. And I wasn't sure it was going to work out. And at the same time, I got an opportunity. A former boss of mine approached me and said, I know you've just moved. I know you're doing something wildly exciting. Let me tell you about what I'm up to. And of course, he was reeling me in all of the time. And I actually got quite interested in that. And he sort of said, look, if you want to come and join us, you would be welcome. But I'm sure you're really happy doing this big thing at British Airways. And of course, the thing I went there to do wasn't there in front of me anymore. And I just, at that point, I kind of decided to remove myself from the situation. And whether that was the right thing to do or not, I don't know. If I look back, I'm really happy with where I am now and that journey, which I would not have done what I've done and where I've been had I not made that decision. It wasn't a straight line one to take. It wasn't the one that was advised by many people for me to take. Now, I don't think I quite appreciated the impact of the decision that I was making, at least in the outside world, and how interesting that became for people to want to tell stories about me. And that made me really uncomfortable because it felt like, this is my job, it's my career. Why are you wanting to write these things? And of course, it's naive. It's like, bloody interesting. A big marketer at BA goes after a year. That made me very uncomfortable. Mm. And I wasn't comfortable in that environment at all. But I've made the decision. And that was one where I actually got out, right? So you can say, stick it out. A lot of people saying to me, it will change. Stick it out. A couple of years, they'll change the organization again. Quality rises to the top. Is something that Sil always said to me, they'll see the value in you. I decided not, I wasn't sure. And I thought, nope, they've made their decision, I'm going to make mine. And so I was maybe a little bit hasty, I don't know. But I decided to go somewhere else and to walk away from a situation that I found uncomfortable. And some of it was about the role that was being offered, but it was also about the values of the organisation that I found myself in. And it didn't fit with me. I didn't think that's how you should treat people. Maybe that's a bit egotistical, I don't know, but it didn't fit with me. And so I thought, right, I'm gonna, in a way, I went into a very different situation, but with some of the team, and at least working for a leader that I really trusted, and that I thought we together would go on a different journey and I would go and do the other thing.
It's interesting, isn't it? You know, I've heard you say being unsettled, the value, the kind of how you feel, and just, you know, what makes you feel like it's a right environment and the way that you're treated and respected. That whole piece around respect, and again, I've seen it with you. You know, you are very direct and very straightforward to work with. I've worked with you lots of times. Mm-hmm. I know lots of agencies that have worked with you. And in many ways, that directness and honesty is quite unusual because it's not what a lot of people do. Mm. A lot of people are terribly smiley, particularly in our industry. They're very smiley and it's all lovely, but actually they don't really tell you the truth. Mm. And it does feel like that some of these things that you've had at the beginning of your career has created you as a leader in the way that you are because of you know, the either the dislike or the just not agreeing with that kind of behavior, or just having a sense of purpose that's important for you?
Yeah, I think it as you say, it's a sense of shared. I think, you know, if I were to articulate it, it's probably being more clear about the shared values of the people that are sat around the table of the team that you're in. I mean, I think if there's one thing I've learned, is it really helps if the team you're in have got a shared sense of what you're trying to achieve and a shared sense of how you want to do it. It doesn't mean it's going to be perfect and happy families, but that shared agenda of what you're trying to achieve, but how you want to lead and how you all want to kind of show up as leaders for the business, that kind of that really matters to me. And I think I was very fortunate in that those first 20 years of my career, I found myself in cultures and in roles and in teams where it was more of a natural fit, perhaps. And I could therefore have impact, and you can sort of see you can make a difference. And I think it's not just about feeling you're in the right places. I want to make stuff happen, right? I kind of want to do things. I want to have impact. I want to, you know, be famous for doing things. And if I don't think I can be somewhere where I can do that, then that also tells me that that's probably not the right place for me, because I want to make stuff happen and have the chance of being able to do that. So I think those are things that I kind of learned in those early stages.
You know, and I love the fact you say you want to make things happen and be famous for. And, you know, I know your time at Virgin Media with... we have to talk about this advertising, you know, the campaign that I think probably did make you famous, just because it was so exciting and bold and brave and different. Mm. Talk to me about that.
You mean with Usain Bolt? Then I put 5-8. It wasn't a straight line to get to Virgin Media. As you know, I left Idols. I went to Idol Standard.
Yeah, we're going to come back and talk about that. We're going to go on to Virgin and talk about...
Virgin.
Back to that moment.
Well, that you don't join a Virgin brand if you don't want to work on a brand that's got some attitude and has got some personality. And your job is to make sure you instill a bit of attitude and personality into the things you're doing. You know, one of the Virgin values is about red hot. One of the things when I picked up the role at Virgin Media, I sort of felt we, in a way, needed to lean in a bit more to being a bit more Virgin. And we've got the name above our door. We're a Virgin business, and we probably lost a bit of the red hot, become a bit glib and a bit superficial. And I just wanted to do something that was kind of really red hot. We just had this unique opportunity with Usain Bolt in the year that he was going to do the up for the triple-triple in the Olympics in Rio, and we had the chance to make some advertising, some campaign that was going to link Virgin Media to that moment in time. And we just wrote a bold brief, and BBH came up with this great idea. And it was probably one of the most exciting times, I think. You know, when you're on, well, I felt we were onto something, both Ellie Norman, who worked on that campaign with me. We sort of came out of that meeting. I remember my boss saying, "What are you guys on? You're kind of like, you're on, what's happening with you guys?" And I was like, "I think we're on the start of doing something really, really exciting." We were just really fired up. Because we felt that it was going to tell the story of Usain Bolt in a way that really sort of elevated him, but connected him back into the business. You know, it's about this is what it feels like to be the fastest. And so we knew it was going to be very creative, but it would absolutely link back to what we were trying to tell the world about Virgin Media and fast broadband. It was just desperately exciting, but wildly creative. I think some people in the business thought it was wildly indulgent because I wasn't out there talking about 200 megabits per second. And yeah, it was a little bit much more brand led. But it was certainly bold. The results would suggest it was really, really good. I could persuade the business of they wanted to hear what they wanted to hear, but the results were really, really good. And we sold a lot of broadband off the back of that.
Does highlight that bit, doesn't it, about if you want to be bold and brave, it's not always straightforward either. And actually, you know, it was a brilliant idea and BBH made it and it looked fantastic and it did have results. But that is, it's still a challenge, isn't it? You know, big ideas don't always come naturally and not everyone always understands them.
No, and I think, of course, making sure that we were connecting back to growing the business and, you know, businesses like Virgin Media are, of course, have to be completely commercially driven. We were very clear about what this was going to do for the numbers, and we'd got enough data to say that powerful brand-led, proposition-led work done well would connect with audiences. And then when, if you supplement it, it's a campaign that you're choreographing with the relevant messaging that's about good price and proposition. Yeah, that as a coherent campaign, we were pretty sure would do better for the business than just looking at direct response work alone. And we had the data to show that. And actually the results show that it did do that. And all the work that we did over those three, it's a brilliant case study. We won an IPA effectiveness award for it. Ironically, still, I don't think the business thinks, they don't always believe it, to be honest, but the results, yeah, they were good. The sales were good. It was an exciting period of time.
It certainly
revived me, I think, because I wasn't sure before I went to Virgin Media that I actually wanted another job. I have to say my time there, it definitely supercharged me. helped set me back, I think, onto a better path. So. Mm.
And just, what was he like?
He's the real deal. It's ironic, when I remember talking with Ellie when I first went, I wasn't that impressed by him. I hadn't met him. I was more interested in meeting David Tennant. And I was really disappointed when they told me they'd ended the contract with David Tennant. And I was like, that's a shame, because I really want to meet David Tennant. And they were like, we can come to Jamaica and make an ad with Usain Bolt, because they're all made in Jamaica, even though they look like they're in suburban semis in somewhere. You have to, unfortunately, fly out to Jamaica to make them. And I have to say, I went, I met it. He's just absolutely the real deal. I mean, he's everything you expect him to be. He's big, he's bold, he's the most polite, most professional man you can meet. He knows that you're there, you're paying him a lot of money, and he's there to do a job for you. And he works that day that you have with him, as long as you feed him well, as long as he can play his music, a bit like a racehorse, he's got to be well-fed, well-watered. As long as he's kind of broadly, he will work really, really hard for you and get what you need. He knows why he's there. He's been really well brought up. He's really humble. He's very polite. And he's very charismatic. He knows what you want. And so at the end of the day, he will do photo shoots for an hour, a half hour, to give everyone the chance to stand next to him and strike a pose. And anyone who's seen my social media will know that we took full advantage of those opportunities. He's the absolute real deal.
Which is lovely. I love hearing that, you know, and the pictures are amazing. So let me take you back to the time at Ideal Standard. So you went there out of BA with a boss that you knew, a much more kind of entrepreneurial environment. What was that like?
I immediately felt like I was home to a degree. Part of it was because I understood the business really well, even though it was a different category. I knew that I was hired because we were there to transform a business to be much more consumer-led from a B2B business. I knew the category broadly well. I knew the customers. And so there was a degree of comfort that comes with knowing the landscape and what needs to be done. There were six of us running the company. And I liked having being part of a team of six people that are running the company. I like being part of teams that have got the mandate to do stuff. I realize I'm not very good when I'm a couple of levels below. That comes down to a bit of ego, right? I just want to be around the table. And I enjoyed being around that table. And it was really hard because we were trying to turn around a company at a time of economic collapse. It was 2010 when I joined, 2011. It was really, really hard. We didn't succeed. I mean, we didn't. We failed in our endeavour. We couldn't turn the business around fast enough and create the value that Bain Capital wanted. It's private equity. I learned more in those 3 years commercially than I learned in 20 years before that, because when you're on the verge of going out of business every week or month, you focus on cash. I was in charge of all the product portfolio, and I spent more time reducing complexity to improve the working capital situation, because I could understand the financial impact of the decisions that marketing was making on a business in terms of complexity of product portfolio. So it just made me so much more commercially smart than any of the 20 years that I had had before that. So it was kind of an amazing case study in how to try and turn around a business in extraordinary circumstances. And we didn't succeed. I remember in an early presentation, McKinsey saying to us, the one thing that we've all learned is that bad market situations trump good management teams any day. And we're in the middle of the most disastrous global meltdown. And you thought, that's a shame, because we think we're a smart management team. The market situation is terrible, and it proved to be the better of us. And we, towards the end of my tenure there, we broke it up to a degree. We sold a piece of the business and then used that to restructure. And I restructured myself out of the company. It was inevitable. But I could sort of see the writing on the wall. So I was becoming a very expensive person that they didn't need. And I'd rather do it to myself than have someone realise that a few months down the line. So we'd sold a piece of the business, we took the money, we restructured it, and I restructured myself out. And I found myself out of a job for the first time in 25 years.
I seem to remember you either phoning me or we were having a coffee and you going, I think you could do one of these things. These are the sort of things you can do, Suki. And so we did do the 100K race to the stones.
Yeah.
Actually, we did it on the 18th and 19th of July, 2014.
Really?
Yep. Wow. That's when we did it, because I have a photograph of us here. I think that's at the finishing line, but we look remarkably good. I don't think we felt that good. That must be the start, mustn't it? My gosh. Yeah. But I have to say, you know, and we stayed at a tent in the middle of the first day. So it's actually 62 miles.
Yeah.
And it was the Ridgeway. And for me, I mean, I had done those sort of things at the time. I was doing a few triathlons prior to that, and I had done a number of races. I think it was the first kind of race that you'd ever done.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure I'd call it a race, right? I know they call it race to the stage, but it was the first event, yes, like that I had done.
And it was hard. And the thing that struck me about it was, have you got it in you? I have never seen anyone with so much determination. I mean, you probably remember, we started off, it was quite nice and sunny. We ended up in a bloody hailstorm. And you kept going.
The last 5 kilometres of that was probably one of the toughest physical experiences of my life, I think. You're right. I mean, I think 30 miles a day walking, you realise, is really long. And luckily, we were well trained, right? And you'd given me some really good advice. Our blister management was fantastic. We didn't get blisters. Sock management was good. So I had good boots. We'd done some training. So we actually, I think, were reasonably well prepared. It's still a long way. And the thing I hadn't been prepared for was my shins were sort of getting a bit painful. And so I was liberally rubbing on the ibuprofen gel. And it was the first time in my life I realized why they say that ibuprofen is contraindicated for asthmatics, because I'm asthmatic. And those last 10 kilometers, the amount of ibuprofen that I think I had running through my body really started. So those last 5 kilometers, it started to really rain really hard, didn't it? And we were on chalkland, so we were in rivers, I think. And I suddenly couldn't breathe. And I had taken so much Ventolin, if anyone asthmatic is listening, there's nothing you can do. I couldn't breathe. I was deeply in pain. My toenails were coming adrift from the nail beds I subsequently worked out, which is quite painful if anyone's had that experience. And it's like, it's 5 kilometers and you've got to get it done. And it was really, really hard. But I have never been so glad to see the end of anything, I think, in my life again. And the one thing I would say is, thank goodness, I was unemployed at that point, but you weren't. And you had the foresight to book a car back. So as everyone else was struggling to get on buses or trains, the black Mercedes pulled up and we got into the back. And I've never been so grateful to be with someone who's got the foresight to book a car back to London. Because that was really, really tough. It was really tough.
It was tough, but it was that other moment of you either give up or get it done, and you definitely got it done. And actually, fortuitously, most definitely, and slightly bizarrely, it is the moment that also saved my life, rather dramatically, because the following week, do you remember our feet swelled up, didn't they?
Yeah.
Completely. And my left foot swelled up and didn't go down. And I went to see my massage lady that I used to have my massages whenever I was training. And she gave me a massage and she was doing my foot on my left-hand side. And she said, you know, Suki, I know you keep telling me that's a wart on your foot, but I'm not comfortable that it is. Could you go and get it checked? And I remember thinking when she said it, oh my gosh, I've got cancer again. Because everything that was going on inside me was the same as before when I'd had breast cancer, but I hadn't thought about it because the doctors twice told me it was a wart. And it was only because we did that walk. I went to see her specifically and my foot had swollen up. And within a week I had, it was a melanoma. And I'd had, you know, part of my foot taken out. And so it was amazing.
I didn't know that. So, well.
And I think we saved each other because then just as we finish, the irony, I guess, of that was the person who came first in the old age part of that was a gentleman called Tim Davey, who is now the director general to be of the BBC.
Yeah.
And you are at the BBC, possibly during this pandemic, at the most interesting time to be anywhere, but particularly a news company.
Yes.
Just finally, what resilience, what have you learnt as a leader that has just enabled you to be brilliant at this moment in time, or to cope and be there in possibly one of the biggest and most exciting brands in the world, I guess?
It's an interesting question, actually. The whole pandemic for the BBC, I think, has in a way reminded us of what our purpose is. And so I think it allowed us to reconnect with audiences, many audiences, not all audiences, but it allowed us to reconnect with audiences because we became really, really relevant in their lives. At that time, we were a source of information when people needed desperately on a daily basis, local and national information. We were also a source of entertainment and escape. We were a source of home education for parents that were struggling to teach their kids. So when schools had failed to provide any sense of curriculum, the BBC stepped in and said, well, maybe David Attenborough can teach your kids about the environment. It reconnected us, I think, with why we exist for audiences. And in a way, what that did actually is it unlocked a kind of energy inside the organisation. And all of us are struggling with it personally, and we're all struggling with working from home or having to go into the office when you do. But the energy and drive that created inside the organisation was extraordinary. So people did things at speed, at pace, collaborating with teams that is normally extremely hard. So I think it just reminded me and us that when you kind of know what you're up to and it matters and you're all clear about it, the energy and spirit that it creates is just super powerful. It kind of makes you super powerful. And so even when you're outside of a crisis like a pandemic, just spending the time to really reconnect teams and people with what you're up to, why it matters to them. And it might take some time to craft that if it's not as very obvious as the BBC in a pandemic, but getting that can unlock energy, spirit, and working, and just team working that others that other situations can't. So I think it reminded us of that. It also, what it's reminded me of is I've never felt, I think Alan Jope said this also, never felt more connected to the organisation despite the fact that you can't see anybody, but actually being able to connect people in actually quite a human way. And it really reminded me of the power of just human connection. We're all seeing into each other's homes, we're talking to each other whilst the kids are running or partners are bringing in coffees or people are a bit worried or distracted, and I've just taken time to talk with people, connect with people. We've connected more frequently. And ironically, even though we're not face to face, I think we've connected at a more human level with people as real individuals, you know, holistic people working and living. There isn't work life and life, it's just life, right? And I think it's reminded me of the power of sort of human connection as a leader, just to make sure that you take the time for that and value it. And quite early, this is not a positive story for me, but early in the process, my father became really unwell and went into hospital. And it was probably, it felt quite routine, but then it became unroutine and he contracted COVID in hospital. And many of my team, I was quite open with my team who were struggling themselves. I knew many people were struggling with whether it's young children or family. And I sort of shared, I didn't intend to necessarily share, but I shared with some people that I was a bit distracted and I was sorry because my father was in hospital. And it was a small moment, but the connection that people, I think they saw me as a human being. Hmm. And I didn't want it to take that, but it, in a way it took that. And suddenly the feedback I got from people that said that 5 minutes when you shared that with us, we suddenly realized that even though you're a leader and blah, 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 you're just like us, you're a human being. And it just has formed relationships and connections that I think are difficult to replace. So I think it also just reminded me of the power as leaders of just connecting with people at a deep level, making sure you take the time. And then you can have a better conversation about the business. You know, the business is, it's what you're there for in that moment, but it's not everything about you, but you can then have a better conversation about the business and people a bit more open about where they are and what they want to achieve. So there's been, it's out of some difficult circumstance for me personally, I think has come some real learning about the power of deep human connection, and that can be achieved even in a virtual world. In fact, the virtual world maybe has allowed it to happen in a way it couldn't have happened before.
It's strange, isn't it, that even though after all these years of working, of being a brilliant marketeer, of telling stories, of looking at creativity, that a moment of really sharing vulnerability is hard. It's hard, but actually the impact of it, and you can't do it inauthentically. So it's not like something you go, well, share something you're really vulnerable about because it doesn't work. But reminding ourselves to do that is, it makes such a difference, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does.
Thank you, Charis. I've so loved talking to you. After at least 15 years, we've had lots of time working together, sharing times on a Ridgeway. Your tenacity, your brilliance, it's fascinating that at the beginning you talk about not necessarily having to prove yourself kind of academically. You are one of the brightest marketeers that I know, but sharing that kind of journey, sharing some of the difficult times, as well as the brilliant, you know, moments with Usain Bolt and creativity. Thank you. See you soon.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed Reset the Podcast, I'd love it if you would forward it to your work colleagues, friends, and family. Reset the Podcast is a Let's Reset and Advertising Week global production. Executive producer is Richard Larson, with me, Suki Thompson. Thanks to our sponsor, Liars Non-Alcoholic Spirits, and voiceover artist, Talitha Penny. Music provided by Audio Network.